Welcome to the Accelerated Investor Podcast with Josh Cantwell. If you're looking to retire early with forever passive income, you're in the right place. This podcast is the go-to destination for real estate investors, both active and passive, and multifamily apartment investors, both new, intermediate, and advanced. Now, sit back, listen, learn, and accelerate your business, your life, and your investing with the Accelerated Investor Podcast.
So hey there, everybody. Welcome back to Accelerated Real Estate Investor with Josh Cantwell. I'm your host, and I'm looking forward to this discussion today with my good friend, Darren Bloomquist. Darren is the Executive Vice President of Market Economics at Auction.com. He is essentially their live-in economist, if you will, and they just absolutely gather just tremendous amounts of data about the economy and then share that data with their clients. And as you probably know, their clients are banks and institutions that are listing properties on their platform for sale. The other side of their clients are the buyers that are buying properties on their platform. Many of you have probably bought on auction.com or you have looked at properties on auction.com, and Darren's a big piece of their leadership team, especially when it comes to the market economics of what's happening. So as you know, once a quarter, I'd love to bring Darren on to discuss what's going on with the market. So today, we're going to discuss number one, the perplexing labor shortage. Number two, inflation. Number three, housing affordability. And then number four, the existing home sales and a number of other topics as well. I always love to have this discussion with Darren. He brings me up to speed as well as all of our audience up to speed on exactly what's happening in the economy and what data they're crunching. So without further ado, let me welcome in Darren Bloomquist from Auction.com. Darren, thanks so much for jumping on today.
Thank you, Josh. Great to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So Darren, let's jump in right away with this labor shortage. I think so many people are wondering, like, what is really going on? You're just seeing these articles about these ports in Southern California, and there's all these shipping containers. And then you hear the rumors that there's nobody that wants that's working, the longshoremen working on the port docks to pull those off and get them into trucks. There's a shortage of truckers. And then I drive up and down my streets, and every single business seems to have a for hire sign. So tell us about what's going on with this perplexing labor shortage.
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing on the street there is showing up in the macro data for sure. On the left-hand side on this chart, for those of you who are viewing this, basically we're showing the number of unemployed and the number of job openings. And the number of unemployed has been decreasing since it spiked when the pandemic hit last year, but it's been decreasing. And we're now down to, I believe, around 8 million or less than 8 million unemployed, but we're at over 10 million job openings. And so we have 2 million more job openings than unemployed. It actually came down a little bit in August. It was at 2.4 million in July of these, this basically deficit of excess of job openings that of 2.4 million in July. That was the highest the Bureau of Labor Statistics had ever recorded. Their data goes back to 2000 on that particular data point. So, but the strange thing is that we're still 5 million jobs below pre-pandemic levels. So we haven't recovered all of those 5 million. Well, at one point we lost about 21 million jobs. We've regained most of those, but there's still 5 million that we haven't gotten back. But then on the other hand, there's this surplus of 2 million job openings that are not being filled. And so we can get into some of the theories on that. But on the right-hand side, what we're showing, for those of you who are viewing, is the unemployment rate, which has come down to 4.8%. So that looks great. It's coming down very quickly. But part of the reason for that unemployment rate going down is that we're not seeing people jump back into the labor force. And so if you're not looking for a job, you're not counted as unemployed. And so the labor force participation rate was hovering around 63.5% back before the pandemic, it dropped to as low as 60%. It's come up halfway in between to about 61.5%, which doesn't sound like a big difference, but it makes a difference in millions of people. So people are not coming back to the workforce, and there's been some theories around unemployment benefits are keeping people on the sideline. Of course, if you're getting unemployment benefits, you are in the labor force participation. I do have a theory that all the forbearance programs for folks with the mortgage and the eviction moratorium has helped to motivate some people. You know, if you're not having to make your biggest payment every month, which is your house payment, then you may not be as motivated to start looking for a job. That's, I think, part of it. And then part of it is people may be, you know, still scared of the virus, of course, and not going back to work because of that. But at the end of the day, we're kind of end up in this strange situation where we have a bit of a shortage of labor.
Yeah, interestingly enough, you know, that labor force participation rate, even if it's only changed by 2%, when you multiply that times roughly 200 million people that work in the US between, you know, all the working age folks between the age of, let's say, 18 and roughly 70, 65 or 70, it's about 200 million out of the 330 million in the country. 2% on 200 million is 4 million jobs. It's 4 million people that is different than it was just 2 years ago, people participating in the job market.
Yeah, one other aspect of this that I forgot to mention that just has kind of become a thing is that I added in the job quits, so people quitting their job. And that rose to an all-time high as well, just in July and August, around, I believe it was, yeah, over 3 million people quitting their jobs. And so it's not just people not coming back to the workforce, but it's people, in part because of this labor shortage, it's employees have the upper hand. And so more of them are quitting and either leaving the workforce or jumping to another job that it, for whatever reason is more appealing to them, whether that's compensation or the ability to work remotely or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I think, look, one of the great things about capitalism is it allows the free markets to work. And right now what you're seeing is the free markets have been massively disrupted by COVID and then massively disrupted by all this government interference with eviction moratoriums, foreclosure moratoriums. That's not allowing the free markets to work. And so now what we're seeing is the aftermath of the free markets coming back and people now saying, well, look, I'm just, now I need to make more money. My rent is going up if they're working and paying their rent, or they want to buy a new house. House values have gone up tremendously in the last 2 years. I want to buy a new house. And what you're paying me from 2 years ago doesn't cut it anymore. So also there's the people that, first of all, it could be the vaccine mandates. They just don't want to get vaccinated. That's a reason. It could be that their compensation's not covering their bills because of all the inflation, which we'll talk about. So they're going to quit their job and just go find something else. Many people, again, employers that are demanding people kind of return to office, and they don't want to return to office because they enjoy the work from home environment. All you mix that, just it's just kind of a alphabet soup, if you will, of stuff, of different reasons why people would quit. And also, I think people are seeing, like, they're seeing the top 1% or the top 5% or the top 10% of people making tremendous amounts of money, the Jeff Bezoses of the world, et cetera, et cetera. They were really not affected by the pandemic at all. Matter of fact, they probably made out. That's a lot of times what happens in a recession is that top 1 or 5 or 10% of the folks that can borrow money because they're very credit worthy, they can easily borrow money and even at cheaper rates. If you look at what the Federal Reserve has done with lowering rates, the highly compensated. And look, I'm in that category, right? So I'm talking sort of about, I'm certainly not in Jeff Bezos' category, but I'm certainly in the category of somebody who can still qualify to borrow tremendous amounts of money at very cheap rates. It helps someone like me or those types of folks to continue to build their businesses because money's so freaking cheap, right? So I think the regular worker is saying, look, screw that. I don't like the disparity in the economics. I'm out. I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to start over. I'm going to restart my life. You know, not surprisingly, after a pandemic, people are in that state of, I guess, reflection to say, like, what do I want the next part of my life to look like now that there's been so much upheaval? So with all those things considered, you know, I could see it. I guess, Darren, like, how does it get fixed, right? Nobody's got a crystal ball.
Yeah.
But what are some things maybe that you guys are thinking about or theorizing about that kind of normalizes the market? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I mean, I think this labor shortage is just another driver of inflation itself, because as you have that labor shortage, employers have to raise their wages to attract workers. And so as you raise wages, that's going to contribute to inflation as well. And so I think, you know, I mean, I am a big believer in allowing the free market to correct itself, and there may be a little bit of pain involved. Understandably, there was a lot of money thrown at the pandemic, but that if we continue that cycle, we're never really going to get out of this. So you actually, I think allowing inflation to, I mean, there's really nothing, there's not a lot they can do about inflation except for raise interest rates, but I think allowing that to take place and allowing the market to, all the stimulus has gone to heat up both the economy and the housing market. And at this point, we don't need to throw more fuel on the fire. We need to allow the fire to die out, I guess, to continue on that analogy, I think is the best case scenario going forward, and hope that things have not already become so overheated that it's hard to pull back.
Yeah. Yeah, man. I mean, some things are starting to feel like the housing market of 2007, 2006, but for totally different reasons. You know, like back then it was all of the no income, no asset loans, and then the ratings agency qualifying those loans is still AAA rated. Everybody bought those mortgage-backed securities. Totally different scenario now, but regardless, there's a tremendous amount of money in the system. And if you can borrow money and buy assets with cheap money, which is usually what the top 1 to 10% do, they're borrowing money at 1% or 5% and then putting it back in play in their business or buying assets. Unfortunately, the regular working class that's living paycheck to paycheck or maybe month to month or quarter to quarter, you know, they're not participating in all those assets. They're not participating in the upside. So all that upside is still going typically to the very top 1 or 5 or 10% of the taxpayers, of the citizens, because they have the advantages of cheap money and qualifying for credit. So it's very, very unequal. It's very unequal is, I guess, the only way to say it, because the rich are getting richer as interest rates stay lower. Look, again, talking specifically about myself, like we're qualifying for massive loans, right? Tens of millions of dollars to buy apartments, of which most people couldn't do right now. I'm not apologizing for it because that's my business. That's what we do. But I also realize the advantage that these low interest rates are giving me. It's not really fair to everybody, right?
And I think, and if we could jump to inflation, if you went there, the inflation slide, but
let's do that.
You know, that we're seeing all the stimulus adding to the fuel of the economic fire has been impacting inflation. And, you know, originally the Fed called the inflation transitory, but there more folks are coming out, including folks at the Fed, saying it looks less transitory now because we're seeing this inflation at if you take out food and energy there, we're at a 30-year high in inflation in the last few months. And then if you include food and energy, and I'm looking at two inflationary measures here, which are the consumer price index, CPI, and the PCE, which actually is what the Fed looks at, is the PCE index. But those are both showing very similar trends, where we're basically at the highest level, even without food and energy, at the highest level since 2008 there. And so this is a point where the Fed is starting to realize that they're probably going to need to not continue to stimulate the economy, because it's already very, very stimulated. And in fact, pull back on some of the stimulus, and then even potentially next year start to raise their federal funds rate. All of this, which will have impact on raising mortgage rates potentially. And yeah, I mean, so for your scenario, we're in a situation where there's a limited supply of housing. And so the folks who can qualify to buy that housing and have the means to buy that housing are the ones buying it. And so they're taking advantage of the situation like you are in your business, which is totally rational. But certainly there's, there's folks who are not able to buy because there's not enough supply. And so the question is, as interest rates rise, and the next slide shows already we're at an affordability, we're hitting some affordability ceilings or thresholds. And if we're going to see mortgage rates go up next year and it getting more expensive to borrow money, that's going to make affordability even more challenging for these folks who haven't been able to buy. And so that, to me, is going to definitely put some pressure on the demand side of the housing equation.
Yeah.
And that we haven't seen for a little while. But, this is actually data from the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta that's showing affordability is at its worst level since 2008. Now, it was even worse leading into the last recession. If they went back to 2006, 2005, it was even worse than it is now. But we are seeing some of these. There's different ways of looking at affordability, but this is just one that is starting to raise some warning flags, even with the interest rates below, mortgage rates below 3% that we've seen most of this year. We're hitting these affordability thresholds because of the rising prices. And so, yeah, I mean, I think what you said is right. There's folks making hay during this, thanks to the response to the pandemic, the low cost of borrowing money. And those folks are doing just fine. Next year, as interest rates rise, those folks will probably pull back. But the buyers who haven't been able to take advantage of this market may not be able to at that point anyway, because of these rising interest rates.
In my newest real estate investing book, The Flip System, you'll learn the proven secrets and strategies that I've used to be a successful real estate investor. You'll also hear the story of my journey from quitting my job to doing over 2,000 units of apartments. The Flip System is now available for a limited time, and you can grab your free copy at getflipsystem.com/podcast. You'll learn the same proven principles and secrets and investing strategies that I used to quit my job and pursue a life of financial freedom. In this book, I'm sharing exactly how I was able to personally close over 750 profitable real estate deals, make over 400 private lender loans, raise over $30 million, and acquire over 2,000 units of cash flowing apartments. Get my newest book now for free at getflipsystem.com/podcast. That's getflipsystem.com/podcast.
Yeah. Amazing to see all the levers being pulled and pushed all at the same time, right? So incomes are stagnant, but need to go up, right? Because there's employers that need workers. And those employers want to make more money and they need more people, right? So if you need more people and people aren't willing to work at whatever you're willing to pay, you got to raise your wages.
Yeah.
So that's making things more inflationary. At the same time, the Fed is allowing people that lever to be a solo that people are borrowing, which is inflationary. And so, I begin as we're talking here, Darren, I just keep thinking about the average worker. The average American household makes about $60,000 to $62,000 a year. Number of them are working in dual income households, maybe doing things even in the hospitality area, where that hospitality is not coming back very fast. It's coming back, but not as fast as it went and went away. And so how are those folks going to be able to afford any of this? Like, that's so much of the average American middle class that's being priced out of everything, right? And especially if they want a job that pays more, the employer is going to want an exchange of value, right? Exchange of value. Like, what can you do in exchange for more money? And if all you can do is wait tables or bartend, the value exchange isn't there. Like, I went last week, I went to an Outback. My daughter had a volleyball game, right? Stopped at an Outback. I waited. The restaurant was empty. It was maybe five tables taken. The lady said it was a 10-minute wait just to get a table. I'm like, what? And so we waited in the bar for another 10 minutes. So now 20 minutes goes by. Nobody even came to take our drink order. I went over to the hostess table. I said, what's going on? You guys are short of workers, aren't you? She said, yep. There's only two or three people in the entire restaurant working. I'm like, okay, how does that course correct? I don't know if there is an answer.
Yeah, well, I think the market can figure that out. There's maybe some painful points to go through. I mean, are you as a consumer willing to pay more to get that service? Or is there a certain point where you say, well, it's not worth it. I'll just go somewhere else or get my food somehow, some way else.
Grow it in the backyard.
You know, I think your question is really a good one too about what are those people going to do, those average workers. And I think one of the answers is in this heat map here. And we've talked about this before, but somewhat enabled, this was already happening before the pandemic, but accelerated by the pandemic, they're going to move away from those orange areas in the heat map. And they're going to move to the, whatever that color is, olive areas in more in the middle of the country to find affordable housing. And there's more of them that can do remote work now. So that helps them. But again, we were already seeing that trend before the pandemic. And so that I think that will continue.
Right.
People will chase that affordability in terms, at least in terms of the housing, to help be able to survive.
Yeah. I just read an article this morning about the CEO of ARK Financial. It's a multi-billion dollar hedge fund. And they're moving their offices from New York to St. Petersburg, Florida, right? So who doesn't want to be in St. Petersburg, Florida, right? St. Pete Beach, right? Warm, nice, no state income tax, more affordable. And she mentioned in the article that St. Pete Beach costs about 20 to 25% of New York City. So you take whatever wage you're making, let's say it's $400,000 and you can afford a $4 million house. Well, now you're still making 400 grand, but that same house is only $800,000, right? It's 20% or 25%. So how much more affordable does that make it? It's amazing, right? So this is one of the reasons why we buy apartments in the Midwest, the South and the Southeast and the Sun Belt. Really can't find many deals right now in Florida. And as you can tell from the heat map, this is affordability for residential housing, but apartments, they react very much the same. This is why we have buildings in, you know, outside of Atlanta. This is why we have buildings in Mobile, Alabama. This is why we have buildings in Cleveland, because it matches the affordability. Prices for apartments and for housing are very much in lockstep together. And so again, you know, you look at these high taxes in these certain areas like California, the Northwest, the Northeast, and the affordability issues, there's no surprise, I guess, those people are moving and moving quickly.
Yeah.
So Darren, maybe let's cover this next slide and then maybe wrap up for today and have you come back in a part two, because there's so much. I feel like we already covered so much that we should do two parts here. Maybe have you come back next week and record again. But I do want to talk about existing home sales and what's happening with the appreciation of home sales, existing home sales, the number that are trading and selling. You know, we talked right in the middle of the pandemic when it hit. I think it was in April of 2020. We talked about the drop-off in March of the number of people that were listing their properties for sale, and supply went down like 65%, but demand only dropped by about 20 to 25%. And I remember talking then, which was over 15 months ago, about how we predicted that prices would go up. And that's exactly what's happened. So what's the state of the market today?
Yeah, so you see, if you look back there, we see a classic V-shaped recovery in the housing market with the home sales on the left-hand side. They did drop for a few months there, March, April, May, June, but really started to come back in after that and have been very strong. Now what we're seeing is the first signs of a pullback from that. You see on the far right-hand side, if you're viewing this, that we saw the first decrease in home sales year over year first time in 14 months. Now, part of that has to do with we had such a strong market last year. But that is pulling back a little bit. And I think it ties into the affordability conversation, is that buyers are starting to say, hey, like, you know, say, this is too much. We can't afford this. And so they're actually starting to pull back a little bit. So demand is starting to pull back. We've seen a decrease in home sales. I don't have it on this slide, but we have seen over the last 3 to 4 months, we've actually seen a gradual increase in inventory of homes for sale. It's still very low, but that is gradually increasing. So I think we've turned maybe a little bit of a corner. I actually think that's a good thing for the housing market. Mm-hmm. We're still seeing home price appreciation of 15 to 20%.
Crazy.
Even with this slowdown. So, I mean, it's just, it's really craziness. But because the affordability is worsening, I think that should cause buyers to react. And I have it in a couple slides, but one of the leading indicators of buyer demand is buyer sentiment with some of the surveys that are put out. And University of Michigan's survey, consumer sentiment survey, home buyers, there it's on slide 6. I mean, this is actually pretty astounding to me. It's the lowest since 1982.
Wow.
Of folks who say it's a good time to buy a home. And that has dramatically dropped, as you can see. A year ago, people thought it was a great time to buy a home, actually, even in the midst of a pandemic. But that has dropped, and it really has to do with people saying prices are too high. And they're pulling back because prices are too high. So I think that's a leading indicator of demand. We're going to continue to see home sales start to slide a little bit and home price appreciation slow down over the next year. Now, the one thing I think I've said this before, but if we don't see that play out, a cooling of the housing market, then we're definitely going to be in danger of forming another housing bubble. And right. And I don't know how that would happen, but yeah, I just saw a headline this week from Goldman Sachs predicting home prices will be up another 16% over the next year. And I think if that happens, we will be in dangerous territory. A lot of other economists are predicting more like over the next year, home price appreciation will slow down to more like 3% to 5%. I think that's a much better scenario for the long term than if we see another 16%. Increase over the next year.
I don't like to see 15% appreciation. I mean, I don't mind. I sold off almost all my single family rentals because we saw that appreciation. So we've sold off a ton of them this year to just capture the equity and trade those into some apartment buildings. But when you see annual home price appreciation is 15%, and that's the slowest pace in the last 6 months, some scary numbers. It's good in some ways, but completely unsustainable over the long haul. Yep. And this slide 5, which we had skipped over. Again, if you guys are catching this, just the audio version through a podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, this is available on YouTube with the slides. Go to the Accelerated Real Estate Investor YouTube channel, and you can see all the slides and the entire video presentation as well, which Darren does always such a fabulous job of collecting and then aggregating and then sharing this data and interpreting it. So let's touch base with this one last slide before we wrap up for today about inventory. You mentioned that new home inventory was up, inventory is coming back, but still not nearly at where it used to be. So let's talk about that for a minute.
Yes. I mean, both existing home inventory, that has started to come up, but then new home inventory, which is really the only type of inventory that's truly new inventory, that's definitely started to pick up. We saw a 32% increase year over year in inventory of new homes for sale in August. And that's now the fourth consecutive month where we've seen that inventory increase. So the builders have gotten on board and are building as fast as they can with all the supply chain disruptions and all of that. So supply is coming back a little bit, the new home supply. And so I think this all ties into the argument, though, that we should see a cool down in the housing market, because you have, as we just talked about, demand is slowly decreasing due to the affordability constraints. And now you have supply increasing. That should help, I think, get the market back to a little bit more of an equilibrium, a healthy equilibrium, where prices are not going up 20% a year, but going up more like 3 to 5% per year. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you also see inventory, instead of 2 months of inventory on the market, maybe more like 6 months of inventory on the market, which is historically considered kind of the equilibrium in the housing market. So that's the supply coming online also points to that movement toward equilibrium over the next year.
Yeah. So again, there's all these levers, and kind of as we kind of round for third here, head for home, kind of wrap up this particular edition of the podcast, this particular episode, which, you know, I'll have Darren come back very soon here, because there's so much more to talk about, but there's these the levers that Darren mentioned. So supply is getting up there. It's coming back. That's good, because that's going to even out the market. Secondly, interest rates need to go up. That will, again, bring some of the buyers, some of the property values back in check, because people aren't going to be willing to pay so much because their monthly payment is more because the interest rate is higher. That would be a good thing, right? To see the interest rates go up. So the market would slow down a little bit. That would be another lever. People getting back and gobbling up these jobs and having more buyers in the market. The more buyers in the market with good incomes means there's more people that can qualify for loans, although those loans should be more expensive because interest rates should go up. So that would be good to have more people owning those homes and buying those homes, affordability, especially if they're paid more because of inflation. The employers are willing to pay more for wages. Those wages allow people to stabilize their lives. I don't think if these people get back to work, they're immediately going to be buying homes, right? They have to have 2 years of solid income to qualify for a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loan. Just because these people go back to work doesn't immediately put them, they're not immediately put into the buyer pool of people buying homes. But it does, again, stabilize and normalize the market. One thing that's, you know, abundantly clear is that with a change in administration and then COVID, then all this supply, we're in a completely different place right now in October than we were 2 years ago when the election took place. Just, and COVID hit, well, actually, it was a year later that the election took place. We are in a completely different place. Mm-hmm. I think it's the upheaval, the change that people are starting to get unsettled with, right? Now you're starting to talk about, hey, there's also all of this possible developer debt in China that these people might not be able to pay. Well, remember, it was Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns that took down the original U.S. housing market that reverberated throughout the entire world economy. So we can't be blind to the fact that China has 65 million housing units that are unoccupied, and they have a huge glut and developers that can't afford their bills. That stuff will probably reverberate into our economy at some point in the next couple of years. Yeah. So the faster we can stabilize and normalize our own economy and get ready for some reverberation from other economies, the better, right? So Darren, listen, fabulous discussion today. We've got to have you back as soon as possible. Thanks so much for sharing this information. Now, again, tell my audience every time, they've got to go to auction.com/in the news, which is Darren's basically media portal, if you will, where they put out all kinds of reports and posts and data that you guys have to download, register for that, opt in on their website. And of course, go to auction.com to look for inventory and properties. Next time Darren comes back, we're going to talk more about the eviction moratoriums, the foreclosure moratoriums, and the amount of supply that's going to be coming back on the auction.com portal to show you guys places where you can buy more properties using the auction.com tools that are available. Darren, any other place that people should go on your website to get data or any other freebies, if you will, or places or things they should get?
Well, yeah, of course, you can always go. There's no cost to go and search for properties. And we do have a little sneak peek at our next podcast is that we are seeing inventory start to come back on the foreclosure side. So you can do a search. You don't have to register anything until you actually bid. And then one other thing, if you look on the In the News section, we've just recently posted a video. I should have said hi, Josh. I mean, I flew out to Dayton, Ohio, and we spent some time with one of our buyers there who's buying distressed properties and rehabbing them and flipping them. And we have a video of that experience and just what she's doing in the community there. And so that'd be a great thing for your audience to check out, someone who's actually doing this on the ground there and happens to be in Ohio.
Nice. Love it. Yeah, check out that video. Again, they can find that at auction.com/in the news. Mm-hmm. Check that out, as well as all the reports. A lot of this information that Darren and I are sharing on the podcast today, the YouTube video today, is available there at auction.com/in the news. So Darren, listen, thanks again. You're always such a wealth of information, knowledge, and I look forward to this because it just so helps me prepare for what could be coming down the pipe. So thank you for being on today, and I look forward to having you on the next episode here very shortly.
Thanks so much, Josh. I really appreciate it.
Hey, Josh here. And do you want to win a free Accelerated Investor t-shirt? All you have to do is give Accelerated Investor, our podcast, Accelerated Investor, a rating and a review on iTunes. Okay? Do that now. Then send us a screenshot on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter. What we're going to do then is every week we're going to pick our favorite rating and review, and we're going to send that person a free t-shirt and maybe, again, some other cool, fun stuff as well from Accelerated Investors. So, again, don't forget to take a screenshot. Leave a rating, review, take a screenshot, send it to us so we know exactly who you are, and then once a week, every week on the podcast, we will announce a new winner. Don't forget to take a screenshot and send it to us so we know exactly who you are. We'll announce a new winner every week.
You were just listening to the Accelerated Investor Podcast with Josh Cantwell. If you enjoyed this episode and learned something new, help us build the AI community by leaving a review and 5-star rating on our iTunes podcast channel. Also, don't forget to subscribe so you never miss another episode. To see passive investing opportunities, visit freelandventures.com/passive. To start your journey toward the lifestyle you've always dreamed of with multifamily apartments, apply for one-on-one coaching with Josh at www.joshcantwellcoaching.com.